I'd like to first start by thanking everybody for making it here this evening. This is a shiur which you didn't have to come to. This is a shiur on a busy Monday night that you decided to come to, which indicates the fact that each and every one of you, in your own way, is trying to advance, is trying to build something into the tefillah that we do. We do regularly, be it for some people daily, some people weekly. At various points in our lives, we have the opportunity of engaging in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, engaging with Hashem. And for many of us, it's a ladder. Some points we feel low on that ladder, some points we feel higher on that ladder. I'd like to start by, first of all, just recognizing the fact that although this is a special series hoping to spark off further thought about this, we in our very shul have the opportunity on a weekly basis for those who are able to manage. The Rabbi Talabam, gives a shiur in Pesukah Dezimra for ladies every Tuesday morning. So for follow-up in terms of continuing, for those who are able to make it, it is there. In terms of just a specific series, I'd like to focus on two things with you in the coming 2 weeks. Number one is that when you pick up a siddur, when you hold gently the pages of a siddur, I'd like to consider tonight what you're holding, what this is made up of, why, what's the agenda of what we're holding. And next week, God willing, try to understand the efficacy, how tefillah itself works. So without much further ado, as all of us pick up our siddur, be it our favorite siddur, something you're used to, something you're not used to, something you're trying to get used to, you hold in your hands something of centuries. You hold in your hands history. But there are many authors. When you look at a siddur and you read different paragraphs, there are many authors within that siddur. The first author, the first and earliest author of that siddur that we hold is, in fact, anybody know? Who is the first person that we hold in our hands? First author that we open up as we start is, in fact, the paragraph that we say on the Shabbos, Mizmor Shir L'Yom HaShabbos. Mizmor Shir L'Yom HaShabbos, this is a perek in Tehillim, to be found in the All Hebrew Art Scrolls on page 221. Who composed that?
David Amar.
Actually, much earlier than David HaMelech. The Midrash, in fact, relates this back to Adam HaRishon. Adam HaRishon, in fact, was the author of this paragraph, as the Midrash relates, as he experienced the first Shabbos in history. So when you open up a siddur, you are essentially looking into the history of humankind from its earliest moment of evolution. Mizmor Shir L'Yom HaShabbos is where we start with Adam HaRishon. To take a perspective on that era of history, we're in a timeline of 2,000 years before anything else really happens. Bereshis and Parshas Noach, really, until we get to Avraham, is a span of almost 2,000 years in which there's nothing which really specifically goes on that we're told about. But then we get to the next one. I heard there was another author that somebody mentioned. Who would be another author that we read as we read the Siddur is?
Moshe.
Earlier than David.
Moshe.
Is Avraham is in Tehillim, but in specifically, we say on a Shabbos morning, Tefillah l'Moshe ish ha'elokim. This is the Mizmor Tzadi in Tehillim. Tefillah l'Moshe. Moshe composed this. It has very, what we'll call, timely and deep metaphoric concerns about the world at large, the justice of the world, the justice of God in the world. We move to Tefillah l'Moshe. This is the era already now. Moshe Rabbeinu living in the year 2368, already in the era before Matan Torah, entering Eretz Yisrael. And as we're about to say, who's the next author, the next explicit author that we have in our Siddur as we walk through is? Somebody said it beforehand. So interestingly enough, so Bruce is bringing up a very good point, is that in fact Yahushua is attributed to Olein L'Shabach. This is more of a survey, so I'm not going to go through every specific one, but some people actually attribute Olein L'Shabach to Yahushua. A more well-known is Ashrei Yoshev Esecha. Who's that? What's that Mizmor called that we say three times in Shachris, or three times a day? Tehillah, the David. It's David's prayer. We've moved now into history a little further along, David HaMelech revealing in the year 288. A span, all the way through the span of Shoftim, another 400 years later than Moshe Rabbeinu, who is effectively the main composer, I apologize for the angle, the main composer or author of Tehillim. There are 10 authors of Tehillim. David HaMelech is one of the primary ones. So we move from the beginning creation, from Adam HaRishon to Moshe Rabbeinu to David HaMelech. But it goes further. This is a quick survey just to get a sense of appreciation. After Moshe Rabbeinu, any takers on next? as there's many in between.
B'nai Korach.
As the B'nai Korach, but that doesn't make it as much, isn't it, in the Siddur when it comes to Rosh Hashanah B'nai Korach come up? There is B'nai Korach over there earlier. Another aspect we say every day in the morning is Zocharosim Abris. Who said the statement that God created a new covenant? The new covenant which was made with Israel, that we say every morning before Az Yasher, is the words of Nehemiah, the statesman. Nehemiah and Ezra, who lived. Now look how far we've jumped in terms of history. Ezra and Nehemiah, who live at the times of Antiochus, let's pull this over a little bit over here. Let's pull this over. We're now living at the end of the Churban Habayis. The end of the Churban Habayis, Rishon, just after the miracle of Purim, a coalition is formed, a council is formed called Anshe Knesset HaGdola, who are led by Ezra and Nehemiah. Ezra is the spiritual sage who leads Israel back into the second commonwealth of Israel, and the statesman, the person empowered politically, is Nehemiah. And at that point, there's a renewal. And that's what we say for Choras Emar Bris every day in the Siddur. But we go further. As you'll notice here, we're going across history in all directions. The next, and this is perhaps the most important, is the Shemona Esrei. Who composed the Shemona Esrei? Who was the people who actually put the words in? Anshe Knesset HaGdola. At exactly almost the same time, Ezra and Nehemiah formed Anshe Knesset HaGdola, but it was a longer period of time. Anshe Knesset HaGdola formed the Siddur as we know, and we'll get the Shemona Esrei as we know. Then, moving a little further on in history, when we say the brachos of the Birkas HaTorah every morning before we start davening, we say after it a pasuk, a Mishnah, and a Gemorrah. Where does the Mishnah come from? Which era of years? Common era. The Mishnah is formed from where? Which era? Mishnah is closed at the end of the Second Temple, or near the end of the Second Temple in the year 200. That's the period called the Tanaim, where the people of the Mishnah spoke. We then go back to the next paragraph in Birkas HaTorah again, where we say, Eilu Dvarim She'en Lahem Shir, a Gemorrah. The Gemorrah finding fruition 300 years later, ending in the year 500 in the period called the Amoraim. Fascinatingly enough, though, in the period of the Amoraim, there was one person who composed one paragraph of Ashmona Esrei. That was from later. Who was that? There's one paragraph in Ashmona Esrei, which was not from Anshe Knesset HaGdola, which was Lamal Shinim. Notice that we call our Amidah the Shmona Esrei, which means the 18. But in fact, there are 19 brachas if you count them. That's because the 19th one, which is Valamal Shinim, to the heretics, in that period of time was added by a person called Shmuel HaKatan. Shmuel the small man. He was the one who specifically composed that paragraph because when he was thinking about the heretics and enemies, he wasn't thinking about his neighbor. He wasn't thinking about that person who irritated him at work. He was able to compose it in a completely altruistic sense which would resonate throughout the generations. We move on to get even a greater sense of history. Move out of the era of even the Tanaim and Amoraim. We read every Shabbos, Av HaRachamim. When was that composed? Av HaRachamim we talk about just before Ashrei on Shabbos as we're putting back the Torah. Which era does that come from? As we move further, this comes from a very troubling era in Jewish history. The Crusades. The first Crusades. And listen to the words. When you hear somebody saying it beautifully and with a lot of chazonos, just listen to the words. Hashem, don't ignore the cry of the blood of the innocent. That's what it's talking about. It's very sad. That's why it's left out a lot of times when there's a time when it's coming to Rosh Chodesh or Nisan and so on. That's from the times of the first Crusades. Then we move onwards. Let's take, for example, at the end of davening every day, we say that 13 Ani Mamins. Who composed the 13 Ani Mamins? We believe the 13 principles of faith. This is Maimonides, Rambam, living in the era in the 11th and the 12th to 11th century, 12th to 13th century. The Rambam, who composed at the which were formalized into the Siddur later on, the Ani Mamin. Finally, let's go further. In the Slichos, which we say on certain occasions, let's go a little closer here. There are many authors. One example of an author, take a look, the Ra'ah scroll says it right here. He says, Yamachaber Chasam Shmoy. The author wrote his name in it, Yitzchak HaKatan Rabbi Meir. Who's this? Baroshe HaCharuzim. Yitzchak HaKatan, the son of Rabbi Meir, who is Harivam, Mibalei HaTosfot. He is one of the sages who was part of the Tosfot Academy. That was an academy living in northern France in the 12th century. Part of this is Rabbeinu Tam, who is his brother. This is also part of our Siddur. Let's take a little further. As we go a little further into the Siddur, we also find, for instance, we'll find what's called the Vidui Shel Rabbeinu Gershom. In our shul, we have the practice on Yom Kippur Katan to say the Slichos on Yom Kippur Katan. Among them is the Tefillah of Rabbeinu Nissim. Who is Rabbeinu Nissim? Rabbeinu Nissim lived in Girona, who was a famous sage who lived in the 1300s. also incorporated into our Seder. And coming towards the end of our journey, just as an example, every Friday night, we say, Lachadodi. Who composed Lachadodi? Rav Shlomo Alkabetz, living in the 1500s. In Sfat, he was a contemporary of the Beis Yosef, contemporary of the Shulchan Aruch. He was a contemporary of of the Arizal, living in those times in Sfat, at the high point of the teachings of Kabbalah at that era in Sfat. And then finally, just as an example to contemporary times, every Shabbos we say in the Shul, Avinu Shebashamayim, which is a much later addition, which is all the way down to the Rabbanit Rashid in Israel. So just to get a certain perspective of what we're doing, when we hold in our hands over here a Seder, you're not simply holding in your hands the writings of a person, of one specific person. You're holding Jewish history. The contours of Jewish history are there in those pages. And as you open it, you're reading the perspective, you're reading the hearts of those people all the way throughout the centuries. And that's all we have every time we open the Seder. History. Jewish history as it's formed and formulated around those events which make us who we are. But, Lahavdil, when you have an anthology, let's say an anthology of poetry, you may have many authors, you have many contributors to that anthology, but if you want to know what that's about, you really need to understand who the editor was, right? Meaning, you have a piece of poetry which is put in many different anthologies for different reasons, because it's fulfilling different agendas. Who, first of all, is the editor? Who is the overall editor of the core Seder itself that put these pieces all together? And then, what was the agenda? What was the agenda of that person or that group of people in order to understand the point of all these different authors, all these different people coming together, Lahavdil, as the Seder coalesces into what we know it? And it is fascinating that the Seder essentially comes to fruition, comes to closure. At which point in history? When does the essential Seder coalesce, the structure of our Seder come to being? So which point? What was that?
Ga'onim.
So the official Seder, we have the versions of the Ga'onim. Later on, already in we'll call the period 500 to 1200, we see many Sederim arriving. But even earlier than that, the actual structure of Tefillah as we know it arrived a little earlier. Who fixed that? Who actually wrote the text of the Tefillah and coalesced the rest of it into it? Was Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. But let's take a step backwards. When we looked at the timeline there, if we can get back to it for a moment over here, where Anshei Knesset HaGdolah is, this was a very varied time of history, if you look at it. You have the temple, the first temple, which lasts for 400 years. It's destroyed around the year about 400 BCE, 423 BCE. You have the miracle of Purim in that goddess in Bavel, and about 70 years or so later, there becomes the revolution, the return to Zion. Was this a successful return to Zion? Was this a successful rebuilding of Israel? Unfortunately, by most accounts, no. A sum total of 42,000 Jews went from Babylon to Israel. Most of the community remained in Babylon. And even those who went experienced such opposition by the people there in the rebuilding of the temple, which stopped and started many times, if you read Ezra and Nehemiah. And there was assimilation. And there was intermarriage. It was to such a point that, in fact, when Ezra and Nehemiah wrote this Charosim HaBris, the new bris which they made at this time, there were so many people who were intermarried, not even speaking the language of Hebrew at that point in time. That's the context of the Seder. That's the context of where the Seder arrives at. And if I could draw your attention to the source, I apologize if there's not enough. If we could just share, if that's possible. Listen to the words of the Rambam on the second page. If you don't have one, you can just make sure that your neighbor does, or vice versa. Can your neighbor who has one make sure that the person next to him is able to see? So let's say top of the second page, under the segment history. This is the Rambam. This is Maimonides as he describes the context of creation of the Seder. Listen to the era which he describes. Kevon shegalu Yisrael b'nei Nebuchadnezzar. Since the nation of Israel was exiled at the time of Nebuchadnezzar, Harasha, Nisarvu b'fras v'yovon, they became assimilated in Persian and Greek culture, v'shara umos The Noldulohem Bonim Ba'artzos HaGoyim, and they had children in their diaspora lands. Ro'osan HaBonim Nisbalbalu Svasam V'hoisos Svas Kol Echod V'Echod Mu'reves Milshores Harbe. And they did not speak Lashon HaKodesh anymore. They didn't speak the Holy Tongue. What did they speak? They spoke a mixture of the nation, of the languages germane to those cultures. V'kemet Shehoya Medaber Eino Yochol Ledaber Kol Tzarchoi B'Lashon Achas. They would not be able to speak in one language, Ela b'shibush, rather in a crippled fashion. V'shenemaru b'nehem chatsi medaber ashtodis, and he quotes a pasuk, that half of them were speaking the language of Ashtod, which was a Samaritan language of the time. V'eino makirin ledaber yehudis, and they didn't know how to speak Jewish, the Jewish language. V'kalashon am v'am, v'bneze, and because of this, because of the dire straits of the culture of Israel at such a time, he didn't know. Individuals were not able, they didn't have the capacity to be able to express their requests or express their gratitude to Hashem in the right way. They started mixing different languages. What they did was, Ezra decided, now's the time. We need to fix something. We need to create, we need to capture this moment before it devolves even further. What does he do? He takes 18 brachos. He creates with a framework. And there's a specific framework we'll get to at some point. It says, Shalosh Rishonos Shevach Lashem. The first three are praising God. V'sholosh achronos Hodaya. And then the last ones are thanking God. Those are the introduction and conclusion. And the middle 12 would be where a person requests. We're going to have to discuss next week why that's the centerpiece of tefillah itself. So the context says the Rambam, the context of the creation of tefillah as we know it, the fixed tefillah, which the Shemoneh Esrei is the core, and everything which surrounds it is layers after that, is what's the reason? Was people were losing it. They weren't able to get it anymore. They weren't able to get that moment to express it as they should have been able to prior to this. But the fascinating thing over here is the engineers of something in Judaism, the engineers of the Siddur have blueprints. They didn't just suck this out of their thumbs. They didn't make this up on the spot when they thought it appropriate. They had a blueprint. What was that blueprint? What was the blueprint? What was the groundwork? What was the architectural groundwork for the Seder that Chazal used, the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah used at this point in order to generate this structure of Tzvila as we know it? And within this, there lies a fascinating story. There lies an incredible story throughout this, that resonates throughout the rest of Jewish history. And it's found in a very short and terse Midrash. This is a Midrash Mechilta to be found on the top of the next page, which doesn't seem to be too extraordinary. Yet it tells a story of Jewish history. The Midrash says the following. This is a Mechilta. The Mechilta is a Midrash Halacha to be found on Sefer Shmos. It says the following. U'lo'avdoi b'chol avavchem, and to serve him with all your hearts. This is a pasuk from where? Kriyas Shema, that we say. To serve God with all your hearts. Eizo hi avodah shebelev. What is service that is in the heart? Havi Oimer Zu Tfila. That's Tfila. This is one of the earliest sources for the notion of prayer as we know it. Avoda Shebalev. How do you serve God in your heart? Service in the heart must mean Tfila. Vachenu Omer Bedaniel Elokach Diant Palach Le Betadira Hu Yash Binach. The reason why those words sound unusual is that Daniel, for the most part, is in Aramaic. It's written in Babylon. The God, he says, which you praise three times a day, he will save you. B'chiyesh avoda b'Bavel, says the Midrash. Is there service in Bavel? How do you serve God in Bavel? There wasn't a Migdash in Bavel. There wasn't a temple, there wasn't a Mizbeach. How do you serve God there? Elo zu tfila, this is tfila v'cheinu omer, v'zimnin tlasa b'yuma hu barich al birkoyen. Three times a day, you're to bless him. This seems like a very innocent Midrash. The problem is, not the problem, but the shadow to this Midrash is the fact that the word Avoda is not a clean word. It is not a word which comes without baggage. Avoda is a very loaded word. There's a lot of history to the word avoda. Where else do we use the word avoda to describe what primarily?
Beis HaMikdash.
Beis HaMikdash, primarily. Primarily, where is avoda, is service used in the Torah? Explicitly, is in the Beis, in the context of the Beis HaMikdash. So listen to what this Midrash is doing. This Midrash Halacha is now taking a word, avoda, and it happens to be related to the heart, and somehow something else is coming out of it. Tefillah is emerging out of the avoda in the Mikdash, which is strange. Why did the Midrash turn to this specific word and now try to, well, in a certain sense, morph it into something more than what it is? Change it into something quite different. Let's put it in a different context. Throughout all of Jewish history, there are two modes of religious service, and they're quite different to one another. Two modes of religious service, altogether separate. One of them is, as we see throughout history, that our patriarchs, our matriarchs, the leaders of our nation called out to God many, many times. Outside of Tehillim even, without even looking at what David HaMelech did. Time and time again, we see people calling out. Moshe Rabbeinu calls out to God for his sister. What does he say?
Kel na refana
Allah. God, please heal her. That Moshe Rabbeinu calls out at that point in time. Avram Avinu calls out to God. One of the famous calling out to God by a lady on which much of our Torah is based is Chana. Chana at the beginning of Sefer Shmuel calls out to God. We have all the way throughout history people calling out to God in their own particular way. Do you know what time of day Chana called out to God? Do we? No, because it doesn't matter. Do you know what the words Chana used when she prayed to God the first time around? We don't know that so much. Do we know? We know five of the words that Moshe Rabbeinu said. We know that Moshe Rabbeinu spoke for 40 days until the mountain pleading on behalf of Israel, and then in five words prayed for his sister. There doesn't seem to be a format. There isn't a specific formula. There isn't a specific time. It depends on the situation. It depends on what people needed at a time. Sometimes David would be at the top of the roller coaster, praying God from jubilance, from joy, and in the depths, calling out from the cave as he's being chased or pursued by his own son or father-in-law. And that's one form of service of God we see throughout history. But then there's something altogether different. And that is what we call the ritual service in the temple. And that worked very differently. That was time-bound. That was place-bound. The avodah in the temple was something very much specific and strict. To the degree that when you learn Zvachim and Menachos, which relate to these services in the temple, there's what's called pigul, which is a notion that when you're doing a korban, and you think about it, that you're going to do some form of this, let's say, you're going to sprinkle the blood out of the time frame of this korban, you invalidate the korban based on that thought even. When you're sacrificing an animal and you think you're going to eat this animal's meat outside of the place or the domain that it's allowed to be eaten, that invalidates the sacrifice. The sacrifices have specific times and they have specific places. And a specific korban can have different places for different parts of it. Everything is very specific. Everything is structured. And what this Midrash seems to be saying is that the two of them came together. The two of these very different perspectives, the two of these very different ways of serving God somehow coalesced, argues Rabbi Jonathan Sacks in the introduction to his Siddur, in a very fascinating argument. And we see that in a Gemara which many of us have in fact read. This is a Gemara to be found in Brachos on Daf Chof Vav Amud Beis, where there are in fact two sources for the origins of Tefillah as we know it. This is the very bottom of the third page. We're told the following. Itzmar, Rabbi Yossi bar Rabbi Chanina Omar. This is the second last paragraph of the page. It was said, Rabbi Yossi the son of Rabbi Chanina said, Tvilos, the prayer service, Avos Tiknum, the forefathers established. Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi Omar, Tvilos Keneged Temidim Tiknum. And Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi said, the prayer service was instituted based on mirrored after what? The sacrifices brought in the Beis HaMikdash. Tanya Kavasi de Rabbi Yossi ber Rabbi Yechanina and Tanya Kavasi de Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. And they both have tenetic support. What's fascinating about this is you see two completely different modes of serving God. And somehow, when we look into our Siddur, when we look into our Shemona Esrei, looking back out at us are these two things. Think about this for a moment. If the Avos, if the patriarchs, are the essential founders of the Shmoneh Esrei, so how does that work? How do we learn that out of them? Where do we see that they served God in that particular way that is the basis of our tefillah? Avram gets up when? Early in the morning. Says the Gemara, Vayashkim Avram Baboker, that his getting up early in the morning was to serve God, which is Keneged the Shachris. Then we see that Yitzchak went Losuach Basode in the early afternoon before he meets Rivka. That becomes the blueprint for Mincha. And Yaakov Avinu, that at night he arrives at that place. There's some form of tefillah which Yaakov Avinu institutes. That's one set work. But then there's something very different. Do you know that every day in the Beis HaMikdash there were to be two sacrifices? Every single day they were called the Tamid, which means literally the constant. It was brought every morning and every afternoon. It was brought from daybreak until either 4 or 6 hours. And the next one was brought from an hour or half an hour after Chatzos till Shkia. And its fats were burnt in the evening. Very specific times. It's interesting that our tefillah bear both of those. We have the aspect of the fact that there's the Avos, it's the morning prayer, but it's also the morning Korban. There's something very fixed about it. What you see happening over here is that Anshei Knesset HaGdolah look back at history, and as they're formatting, as they're creating, as they're constructing this framework, what do? They look to two very different ways, two very different modes of service, and they inculcate into that, both of them. That's why there's a fascinating machlokes. What's more important? The tefillah which is said by the individuals, or the tefillah which is said by the shliach tzibur on behalf of the entire community? It's a debate. That may be exactly the same point. Is it the focus on the individual, the organic, the specific, or the framed and set work of the Shmoneh Esrei? Which is the primary point? And that's why, in fact, we have a silent Shmoneh Esrei and a loud Shmoneh Esrei as well. There's part for both. There's part for the organic. There's space for our own input. But there's also the structure itself. Let's take it one step further. If it's true that Chazal said that it's necessary, Anshei Knesset HaGdolah said, it's necessary at this point in time to frame something, to create a structure. That's great. But why isn't it that they should give us a book and say every generation should recreate that wheel? Meaning, after all, times change, issues change, the issues that we deal with change, people change, and as we know, the diaspora changes as well. We're in a very different place than we were 500 years ago and even 1,000 years ago. So why didn't they leave us a book and say, it's necessary to have a fixed text, but we'll leave it to each generation to create their fixed text, or let every individual find it themselves? Why was it necessary for them to make it so curtailed, so specific, so captured within a certain snapshot of words as they have it? Why would they have to do that? Any thoughts on that?
To keep it protected from other interpretation.
Right,
the way that the community, the majority rules, and it might not be.
So you're saying it might fall into the hands of, it might fall into bad hands. Mm-hmm. Who's going to actually be able to do it? Meaning, perhaps they might not have the same level of being able to construct that. That's a possibility as well. That's definitely a possibility in terms of, so what's going to be in the future? But in a certain sense, you limit the creativity by making it a framed set work, right? There's a loss made by that decision.
To show connection.
What was that? There's a certain level of connection between the generations because of that. But as you've seen, the Siddur itself does grow. There are aspects of the Siddur which are added. It's just the central part which wasn't, as you said, comes from that particular point.
Since it's an Indian wanted everybody to be saying the same thing. His goal was...
Great. That's also interesting. Meaning, if you're to let it, we'll call it, grow with the communities over the ages, it would lose the sense of the communal prayer as we have it today, which is almost unadulterated across the world in all the different ways. Even between the Taimanim and the Sardin, the Sfarad and Ashkenaz, and all the different... and Nusach Arizal, everything's more or less the same over the centuries. There's been a certain sense of unity within it. These are very valid points in terms of why it was constructed in such a specific way. One of the suggestions also tendered by, I'd like to read with you two specific suggestions. Number one is a suggestion forwarded by the Chovas HaLevavos. Because Lvovus is one of the prototype Musar Sforim, written well over 700 years ago. And it is written, it's attributed to Rabbeinu Bachaye, who says in the second paragraph here, he says the following. Actually, let's start just the top, just to get a sense of the balance over here. He says, Vada, ki amilos tiyena b'loshon, v'kavona b'leiv. That the words are the expression, articulation, but the kavona is to be found in the heart, not on the tongue. V'amilos kaguf l'tfila, v'kavona ruach. It's like if you can imagine a body, a lifeless body, is what the words are without anything inside them. And when you breathe into them, the spirit of life, that's the kavana you put into them. Do you see that? See the two parts over there that he's talking about? There's the fixed words that Chazal gave us. That's the body, it's the meat, it's the framework. And then there's the breath of life, which infuses it, which makes it rise to life. Ukishi yispala l'mispala b'lushono, v'libot harud b'inyan acher zula satfila. And if a person's involved and he's just saying the words, but there's nothing happening inside, t'yeh tfila sakuguf b'la ruach. It's almost like you have a body which is not resuscitated. It doesn't have any life in it. There is value to that. But there's nothing going on. It's still. It's dormant. The body's there, but your heart's not there. And therefore the heart of your tefillah is missing. So it's very important. We have the words, but don't forget there's a very big other component. It's much less tangible. And that's what? The breath which is breathing in that body, which you're investing. Through as you think. And now he points out that this is the important point. It is impossible for the soul to remember this within its entire form and order. What they did was they wrote us a checklist. You know what? It's very hard for us. We've had long days. We wake up early in the mornings. It's going to be very hard for us to approximate, to be able to say the right things at the right time. It's as if you got a meeting with the President of the United States and you had a particular bid. You wanted to tender a specific suggestion. And this was your moment. You have 1 minute to say what you need to say. And everything, your life work depends on this. And you walk in there. Are you going to leave it up to the moment? Are you going to leave it to an impromptu to be able to say what you have to say when you walk in there? Says Rabbeinu Bachaye, no. You will train. You will prepare for weeks, and you won't just prepare for weeks. You will call up the best script writers you know. The people who write his speeches, you'll ask. You want to know exactly how to say the right things the right way. Because sometimes when you leave it up to just the impromptu, when you get there, it doesn't work. Says Rabbeinu Bachaye, that's one reason why we need the Siddur as it is. We need people who know how to say it right. We need people who know what to say at the right time. So when you're standing there, it isn't about, there's something specific, there's a message, there's an agenda, there's an argument which is being made. That's option number one. But let's take it a little deeper. Anshei Knesset HaGdola, this body which formulated the Shmoneh Esrei, lived in a very unusual era. It was the end of an era. What was the era which was ending as Anshei Knesset HaGdola lived? The era of Anshei Knesset HaGdola, beginning the Second Temple. It was the cessation of the kings. The kings had finished. We're going to get kings a little later at the times of Hanukkah. But this is the end of the time of prophecy. In fact, if you go to Tanakh, who are the latest prophets that we have? Who are the latest Nevi'im that we have in our Sifrei Nevi'im? Ezra Nehemiah, but in actual Nevi'im itself is Chagai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Malachi, some people actually attribute to being Ezra himself. They are found at the end of the Treyasar. That's what the shul is doing on Motzi Shabbos in priority one. That's the Treyasar, the 12 books, the minor prophets that are called Ezra and Chagai, Zechariah, Malachi. They were all card-carrying members of Anshei Knesset HaGdola. And whenever you see Anshei Knesset HaGdola talked about in Chazal, they will say, Anshei Knesset HaGdola formed the Siddur, and among them were the last of the prophets. That's one of the descriptions of Anshei Knesset HaGdola, that among them, seated in that assembly, were the last prophets. And that's significant. Because says the Nefesh HaChaim, says Rav Chaim Volozhiner, in the next source, the most incredible thing. It was necessary for the tefillah to be framed, to be fixed, to be caught at such a point in history. It was necessary. Because we needed people who could identify with the human spirit throughout all generations. You see, we have beautiful poets in society. And you can study poets and you can see level after level after level. There's incredible depths in poetry. But you know what? There's still a finite amount of depth to poetry. Because the poet's human. Because the poet only has a certain scope. And we spend lots of time trying to understand that scope. We try to understand their context. We try to understand their life circumstances to be able to get a picture of what they're writing about. When it comes to prophets, they have a bigger scope than the human themselves. It says the Nefesh HaChaim, that when they coalesced, when they created the structure of Tefillah as we know it today, they were not simply looking at the generation right in front of them and saying something which would work for them. What they were doing was they were creating a framework which in which every individual throughout all of history would find meaning in. And it's fascinating. If you think about it, I'm sure if you just were to identify, let's say today, what your tefillah looked like today, or let's say an inspired day in the last few weeks, and then think back a year, think back 2 years to an inspired moment during your tefillah. Usually they're not necessarily the same place. And not necessarily the same thoughts. At one point you're going to be thinking, wow, Modim, I've got so much to be thankful for today. You know, for a particular event that went on in your lives. I've got so much to be thankful for. Another time you'll be thinking, Baruch Aleinu, God, please give me sustenance. This, I really appreciate you. I really see you in that form and that place enough. We ourselves experience the tefillahs differently throughout our very lives. Then look at the people around you. They're experiencing the same thing as well in their own ways. Every individual is going through their own journey and are reaching different points. And they're seeing in their tefillahs their specific resonance all the way through their lives. Twins who experience everything the same. They have the same parents in the same schools and the same friends all the way through their school career, let's say. They still experience life differently and they will see tefillah differently. What Chazal were able to do by creating the tefillah in such a way was creating a framework that every person throughout all history, throughout every moment of their lives, would be able to identify with and see within that structure the truth and to be able to find and adapt to the place where they relate to God in. That's why we needed to have Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. They realized that time was running out. As prophecy is running out, we need to capture it. Because people are losing it. People are not going to be able to do this themselves. And they created this structure which we've kept for those millennia. If I could just read with you in the conclusion, you know, like Jonathan Sachs's introduction to the Siddur, which I could recommend for everybody to read. There are many different Siddurim, and many of them have different ways which are inspiring. But Rabbi Jonathan Sachs is at the end of this conclusion. He says the following. This is on the top of page 5. The transition from sacrifice to prayer was not a sudden development. 1,000 years earlier, in his speech at the dedication of the temple, King Solomon had emphasized prayer rather than sacrifice. Through Isaiah, God had said, "My house should be a house of prayer for all peoples." This is even the time that they had sacrifices. The prophet Hosea said, "Take with you words and return to the Lord. Instead of bulls, we will pay the offerings of our lips." Sacrifice was the external accompaniment of an inner act of heart and mind, thanksgiving, atonement, and so on. Therefore, though the outer act was no longer possible, as we lost the korbanos, as we lost the ritual expression, the inner act remained. That is how sacrifice turned into prayer. What had once been two quite different forms of worship now became one. Prayer took on a highly structured character of the sacrificial service with fixed texts and times. The silence that accompanied the sacrifice was transmuted into speech. Two traditions, prophetic prayer on the one hand, priestly sacrificial service on the other, merged and became one. That is the remarkable story behind the words, "What is your sacrificial service in your heart? This is prayer." Perhaps one of the best ways of thinking about it, or a particular way of looking at this and thinking about it, is the picture just to the right is a picture of a tomato frame. For those of you who are fond of gardening, one can go to Lowe's or any hardware store in the neighborhood, and you can see tomato frames. And in fact, you can actually see entire aisles of them. And generally, all of them will look pretty much the same. They've got the same metallic circles and the same bars which hold them together. What's fascinating is you take three of those home and you put them in your backyard, and you plant those tomatoes, and not one tomato bush will look the same in the same frames. What Chazal did, what Anshei Knesset HaGedola did, by creating this fixed record structure, the body, was planting a tomato frame in our minds, in our history, through which we grow the organic, through which we input our personal, ourselves, our history, our context, as we morph that into our specific prayer. You see, we're tapping into something much bigger than ourselves. As we open up a book, which is authored starting at Adam HaRishon all the way through our generation, and we look through these pages, we have the structure, and into that structure, we invest ourselves. And that union becomes what is known as the Seder. What we're looking forward to doing next week is, this is the structure, this is the background, this is a little bit of the history. Next week we're going to get in now, delve directly into the depths. How does tefillah work? Why should it work? Why is it even necessary in the first place, if God knows? And that's what we're going to be starting with next week. I look very much forward to joining you then. Thank you so much, everybody.